I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Good afternoon. It's Sunday, December 1st, and you are listening to the College Football Daily, a 24/7 sports podcast dedicated to catching you up on and breaking down the day's college football news, oftentimes within 15 minutes or fewer. Not today, probably. I'm Connor Tapp, and on Sundays, the day's college football news is the games that just happened on Saturday. And usually we've got a fair bit more than 15 minutes to talk about it. So Trey Scott has joined me to unpack everything we just witnessed on the gridiron. Trey, let's not bury the lead here. Let's start with Auburn 48, Alabama 45 in the Iron Bowl. When Auburn beats Alabama, they really find an entertaining way to do it. You know, I mean, normally when the number five team in the country loses, we're meant to come away from it feeling like we've learned something meaningful. But anytime Alabama loses in the Saban area, particularly when it's to Auburn, it feels just like a bunch of chaos that it's hard to draw any super meaningful conclusions from. Some wild plays in this game, including a pair of pick sixes from Mac Jones, who had a good game and a bad game at the same time. Very weird. Some controversial calls at the end of the first half with Auburn getting a field goal that Nick Saban doesn't believe should have counted. And then at the very end of the game, Alabama getting drawn into a offside or false start. It was an illegal substitution because they were confused by how Auburn was lining up. So Nick Saban not very happy about any of it. This was everything you want out of an Iron Bowl.
Yeah, I could watch it. I could watch this one all over again. And I think I, you know, lost my voice screaming at the TV. I was watching with my family, and I was like, he's not making that kick. And it's just crazy that Alabama, every time they lose, we sort of have to take a look. Is this the end of the dynasty or the end of an era? And I don't know if it's the end of the Alabama dynasty. That would be silly to say they're, you know, in the mix for a top three recruiting class. They've got 8 of the last 9 number one classes. But it certainly feels like the end of an era. And when you look at that 2017 recruiting class, Tua and the receivers and Najee and Alex Leatherwood and Dylan Moses, that class is over. Alabama might have 7 first-round picks next spring. Offensively, 9 of their 11 guys, starters yesterday, are draft eligible. Men could go. Defensively, it was a mess this season. They might move on already from first-year defensive coordinator Pete Golding. You know, Nick Saban's really not thrilled with how any of that went down. So a new era of Alabama football is going to be ushered in. And I think, you know, we've had a few weeks to think about that now with Tua's injury and sort of, oh, wow, you know, this is all we got of Tua. Well, like, let's broaden that. This is all we got of a recruiting class that truly went down as one of the 5 best classes ever. This is all we get. One national title that they won when most of them were backups, when Tua came off the bench. The first Alabama team to not even make the college football playoff. It's surreal and it's crazy. Don't want to take anything away from Auburn, which absolutely did everything it had to do to win the game and got lucky, of course. But I think it's a pretty bitter year now in Tuscaloosa.
Yeah. And I mean, first of all, we have to say that it's absolutely insane that is the standard that Alabama has set, that not missing the college football playoff precisely once is kind of this concerning sign that there are some cracks in the foundation. But yeah, I mean, we've seen so much turnover at Alabama, and normally it's turnover that we've thought that they've been able to sustain. But I mean, couple of disappointing season with the turnover that's still yet to come, and in an LSU program that has finally seemed to get things figured out. And And even with outside of the SEC West, you've got pressure being applied by Georgia. And even outside of the SEC, you've got Clemson and Ohio State looking like they have opportunities to climb to the top of the college football hegemony here. And so it's the dynasty has to end sometime. And I know people have looked foolish proclaiming the end of it in the past, but I mean, you know, at some point it is going to end. Things are going to start declining. Alabama might at some point have to settle for merely, you know, just a top 10 season, a top 15 season, if we really want to get crazy. But I mean, we have seen them bounce back in the past. They had at three losses in the 2010 season where Auburn won the national championship, and they obviously bounced back from that and continued their run. So we'll see. On the Auburn side of things, I mean, you come away from this and with a newfound appreciation, I think, for Gus Malzahn and this is a game where Auburn had to turn over every single rock in search of an advantage. And boy, did they maximize every single last one. They get the ball back with 33 seconds left in the first half. And instead of just kind of kneeling it out, they go to try to score points, and they come away with a field goal. And then at the very end of the game, instead of just lining up to punt, they use it as an opportunity to sow confusion and Alabama's coverage team, and it results in them committing a penalty that ends up winning the game and not even giving them a chance to go down and tie or win. I don't know that there are a lot of coaching staffs across the country that are so relentless in their pursuit of an advantage as what we saw from Auburn last night.
Well, I mean, it's pretty rare to see Nick Saban get out schemed or, you know, out tricked, but he absolutely right. got tricked in the end of the game. I agree with him that the end of the first half was BS. You know, obviously Auburn should not have had time to kick a field goal. And of course the 3 points comes back to bite you. Gus Malzahn clearly is keeping his job. I thought he should have kept his job ever since week one, when they beat Oregon. Gus Malzahn insists that this team is going to win a championship under Bo Nix. And it's hard not to believe them. Like, I don't know what extent of championship we're talking about, SEC West, SEC, but they go 9-3 against a brutal schedule. And Bo Nix has not been remotely efficient yet. They won that game almost in spite of Bo Nix, which is crazy to say because he had some gutsy plays. The ceiling is super high for Auburn. This win's going to help them on the recruiting trail too, and they'll reload on defense. But Gus Malzahn, Tip of the visor, man. Like, you're the only SEC coach who can beat Nick Saban. Your fans want you gone every single year, every other year. Like Connor, like, we probably know this time next year we're going to be talking about this Gus Malzahn leaving, right? The cycle won't stop. But I hope Auburn fans can appreciate it. I mean, I appreciate it. That was the game of the year. That was. I'm very prone to hyperbole, but when we talk about games of the decade, like, that's in the top 10. It just is. The moment felt insane. That pick six felt like the kick six. Like, that was, I kind of want to hang up off this podcast and pull that game up on YouTube and watch again. That was like a treat for, like, that was a love letter to college football.
Yeah, it was truly incredible. And, you know, we talked about in the past how when you have this kind of top group of teams, the Alabama, Clemson, Ohio State, LSU, they get together against other top 10, top 15 teams, and the lines are double digits and the games are never close. And it feels like the teams at this level aren't capable of being involved in this type of drama outside of being forced to play each other in the college football playoffs. So it's refreshing to see that the power is not so heavily concentrated at the very tippity top of the college football pyramid here, that these kinds of wild games aren't still possible when it comes and we all understand that Alabama is very banged up, but even so, it is a refreshing result.
And I know we're moving on, but you said that about Gus Malzahn, like, he is a desperate enough coach, an ingenious enough coach, a creative enough coach with high school football roots and Veer option and all that stuff. There's a reason Gus Malzahn is responsible for so many of these games the last 7 or 8 years.
It's still interesting that Alabama moved the ball. If this game goes a little bit differently and, you know, that Auburn field goal is not counted at the end of the first half. I mean, in Alabama catches a break, maybe that ball that Mac Jones threw off of Najee Harris's back does not land in the hands of an Auburn defender. And they end up getting some points on that drive instead. I mean, maybe we're talking about, hey, you know what? This Mac Jones led offense just went into Auburn and against the number 4 defense in the country coming in, according to SP Plus, and really didn't miss much of a beat. But
you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. That was the storyline in the game no one's talking about. Like, would Alabama, I know we have another playoff podcast, if they had won this game, they're in the playoff, right?
I think so.
Like, they moved the ball against the top 10 defense without any issue.
Yeah.
That field goal. Oh, man.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on to the game. Ohio State 56, Michigan 27. Some moments of inspiration for Michigan in this one. You know, they scored a touchdown on the opening drive of the game. A few big plays here and there for the Wolverines, but nothing that they were able to do was able to match the steady drumbeat of production from this Ohio State offense. They scored 14 points in every single frame, just an absolute model of consistency. J.K. Dobbins and Justin Fields accounted for 513 yards in all 8 of Ohio State's touchdowns. And just, this is now the, 8th win in a row in this series for the Buckeyes, and including 5 wins over Jim Harbaugh. So, what do we think here?
Well, quiet game for Chase Young. I was surprised at Ohio State's lack of defensive power here. This is a great win for Ohio State. J.K. Dobbins continues to prove he's the best running back in the country. This is a really special player. Justin Fields, did you know, I read a stat this morning. Justin Fields is just 1 touchdown behind Kyler Murray's pace from last year. Justin Fields could have a big Ten title game and maybe make a serious Heisman push. Mm. So the former number 2 recruit in the country is living up to the hype. I was just glad that injury. So we've got 2 weeks in a row now where Justin Fields has suffered a scary-looking injury. Against Penn State, something happens to his left hand. And there are message board rumors that Justin Fields broke his thumb or something. Okay. Saturday, he bangs his knee up. And you've got Twitter doctors, which is my new least favorite thing of college football, saying MCL. That's just an MCL from what I saw on television. Of course, yeah. Justin Fields comes back in. And on the next play, rolls left and throws a sick touchdown pass. But I mean, the drop off for Ohio State between 1 and 2 at quarterback, Justin Fields to Chris Chuganov. I mean, that's stark. Ohio State's national title hopes were hanging by a thread for a few seconds up there in Ann Arbor a week after Justin Fields had already been hurt. So I think my big thing for next week, I'm wondering against Wisconsin, is stay healthy, Justin.
Yeah. And there, I think actually against Wisconsin earlier in the season, there was another collision where it looked like he was going to exit the game, but he ended up not. So maybe he's just made out of adamantium or something. I don't know. But
that's right. It's do you remember last year, Tua, before he finally really suffered an injury last year, Tua went to the tent for 5 straight weeks.
Yeah.
Tua's hurt. Oh, Tua's fine. Oh, Tua's hurt. Oh, Tua's fine. So that's my I hate for that to be a storyline. It's what's this player's health? But that's something. He's taking some weird hits over there.
So we do indeed know that it will be Wisconsin that Ohio State is facing next week. The Badgers dispatched Minnesota 38-17. Weirdly, this game does not this box score does not really look like what you might expect. Jack Cohn kind of went off with some big explosive plays. He ended up averaging 12.7 yards per attempt with two touchdowns. And Jonathan Taylor had two touchdowns, yes, but really only averaged 4.2 yards per carry. But, you know, it's been kind of a bit of a roller coaster for the Badgers this season. Started out thinking maybe they were a college football playoff caliber team. In the end, I think maybe we're thinking very solid team, that the best of a surprisingly strong Big Ten West.
Yeah, I kind of think the same thing about Minnesota. You said Wisconsin had a roller coaster season. So did the Gophers. Like, we, I mean, the air totally out of their balloon today. I was surprised at this result. I thought Minnesota would play a lot better. I thought they could get more going offensively. I certainly didn't expect Jack Cohn to have a big day. I wonder if Ohio State is like, I wonder if they even care about that it's going to be Wisconsin. All I know is it's hard to beat a team twice in the same season. Like, Ohio State beat Wisconsin last, like, in October, 38-7. So I'm not saying Wisconsin's going to put a scare into them, but Jack Cohn wasn't any good that game. And it was close at halftime. So what if Jack Cohn sort of replicates his Minneapolis magic and brings that to Indianapolis? There's a lot of Apolises there. I don't know. I was a little bit more excited about a Minnesota-Ohio State title game than Wisconsin part two.
Yeah, it just kind of feels like Ohio State is a team that's going to kind of come out and do the thing that it always does, and it almost doesn't really matter who the opponent is. At least in terms of what the Big Ten has to offer in terms of challengers. So, yeah, I really don't think it much matters to the result next weekend, who it was, Wisconsin or Minnesota. Ohio State is really good.
Should we talk Jim Harbaugh for a minute? Like, do we have any takes on that? I don't really have, like, I'm not, like, upset at them for losing that game. I thought he made some decisions at times earlier on, like the kicking field goals is not how you beat Ohio State. I saw a lot after the game. Charles Woodson said it too. Like, Ohio State's just more obsessed or into this rivalry than Michigan. It's like Ohio State is devoted on a daily basis to beating Michigan. And that's not like it goes beyond like putting bulletin board things in your locker room. It's how you recruit or how you evaluate or how you coach and how you train. And there's just this sense now that Michigan's fallen so far behind that this is just an insurmountable hump. But in a way, I kind of feel bad for Michigan, because your arch rival has truly been good. Like, there has not been a really bad version of Ohio State except for the Luke Fickell interim coach team in really our lifetime.
Yeah.
Like, Ohio State has consistently been a monster. That is a tough team to be a rival of. Look across the college football landscape. The other rivalries we saw Saturday, Clemson, South Carolina. How many years removed from South Carolina winning five straight now? Oklahoma State is always sort of Oklahoma, Oklahoma State's always sort of toggling back and forth. Ohio State is a monster. I don't know how Michigan's ever going to get over the hump against them. Because we talked this season about Michigan has these inherent disadvantages that a lot of people don't realize. It's not as easy to win there as you would think. And really, it is not a top 10 coaching job in football.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because this result and Jim Harbaugh kind of being dour in the press conference and dismissive of questions is going to be the out note for this regular season, in which we did see Michigan's offense ultimately take some pretty meaningful steps forward, I think, in year one under a new scheme to maybe give you some hope for year two. And even in this Ohio State game, yes, you ended up losing by a lot of points in the end. But I mean, there were some moments, I think, to come away and feel encouraged, at least on the offensive side of the ball, about some things you were doing against a really good Ohio State defense. But because the opposition is so formidable, does have so many things going for it that Michigan simply does not, you're kind of left with this bitter feeling that the Wolverines have now had for 8 years in a row. So yeah, it's a pretty, the fact that Michigan has Ohio State on their schedule every year on top of some of the other resource disadvantages, it's pretty tough.
Michigan's going to be a really interesting team next season because they lose a ton on offense. Shea Patterson, those receivers, many of those receivers, 3/5 of their offensive line. Jim Harbaugh's buyout drops from 12-ish or drops to 10. So we'll see. We'll see.
All right. You mentioned Clemson and South Carolina. The Tigers went into Columbia and did what we thought they would. 38-3 over the Gamecocks. Not a whole lot worth lingering on here, I don't think. Trevor Lawrence goes for 295 yards and 3 touchdowns. And Clemson held South Carolina's offense to 174 yards. I think maybe the thing that got the most attention after this game was Dabo's rant after the fact. He was asked about the significance of this game, and he said, you know, we have to win because if we win, y'all would have wanted to drop us to 20, complaining about Georgia still being in the top four despite losing to the South Carolina team. But, you know, not a whole lot to shake up the narrative, I don't think, coming out of this one. Anything you want to add here about your Tigers?
Key Law has been, since mid-October, like completing 75% of his passes. They've been insane. I think Dabo's what probably just trying to keep the foot on the gas. You're gonna give me some grief here. Does he not have a point about the whole like get Georgia like Connor? You watch the South Carolina team every week, like with one eye closed. How does Georgia excuse this loss? Like, this South Carolina team is atrocious.
Yeah, I don't think it's super excusable. And I don't think, you know, on eye test, Georgia is a top four team. So, I mean, and this, we could get sidetracked into a whole other thing. But I mean, so like, I don't know. And like you're saying, like you were hinting at, like, Dabo, like, what is the purpose of what he's saying here? And the answer is probably to keep his team focused, to keep them in the midst of a season in which they are not, like, Texas A&M presented the most formidable challenge that they'll see until the college football playoffs starts. And that was 3 months ago. So like, how do you keep that team motivated? How do you create that kind of siege mentality, that us against the world mentality, when the reality is that, you know, you're fine. Everything's going great for you. And the answer is that you kind of have to make up things to be mad about. And so I think that's what this is here.
You have to make it up. I mean, the Patriots and the Warriors have so annoyingly the last few years been like us against the world. But you have to. It's like, I do think Clemson probably started off this season. Like, I think the North Carolina game was a result of, like, yeah, going into a weird game against a team that's a lot better than we thought, made a bowl game. But there was probably a sense of, hey, we can just get off the bus and, you know, put the pads on it and win the football game and not really have to be too motivated about proving anyone wrong. And clearly, you know, he's found over the years that this motivation and this chip on their shoulder of proving people wrong is really the recipe here. And it's interesting that the more top flight recruits that Clemson gets, like how that's going to, you know, keep working. But I feel like Clemson's, you know, on the midst now or on the verge of signing the number one class in 2020. You know, I have a feeling he's not going to stop. He's not going to change. Dabo's not going to change it soon. And I think the players who are playing there are probably like down with that. It would be interesting to see this sort of no one believes in us work at like an Alabama. I don't think Nick Saban's ever going to do that. But yeah, I think it's just what he's doing.
So we found out who Clemson will face next week in the ACC title game when on Friday, Virginia beat Virginia Tech 39-30 for the first time since 2003. The Cavaliers won this one. On a recent podcast, I mistakenly implied, even though I knew it was wrong in my head, that it had been since 1993, which is crazy. I just messed up there. Didn't get any hate mail. We must not have any Virginia listeners. But the Cavaliers get the win and become the sixth different team. We've had a unique winner of the ACC Coastal for each. We've gone through the full cycle. Every team in the division has won it. And so the cycle begins anew next year. So, I mean, a little bit of an upset here, impressive achievement for Bronco Mendenhall, to get to be the sacrificial lamb from the ACC Coastal against Clemson in the conference title game.
I think good season for both those teams. Justin Fuente got off the hot seat, turned it around for Bud Foster and then for Virginia. I'm glad I liked them a lot this preseason. I know it hasn't been quite what they expected, despite the fact that they're making the conference title game. Bryce Perkins has been hurt, but he had a career game Friday. And hey, if they don't get beaten too bad, they're going to the Orange Bowl. The Orange Bowl will take the next ranked ACC team. And if no one's ranked, then they'll just choose an ACC team. If Virginia, they'll emerge in the 20s to 25 on Tuesday. And if they can sort of not get humiliated against Clemson, they'll be headed to Miami.
All right, let's hit Georgia 52, Georgia Tech 7. Not really a whole lot notable here, except for the fact that George Pickens, Georgia's leading receiver, was ejected for fighting and will now miss the first half of the SEC title game, which could end up being rather consequential for
Bulldogs. And don't forget Lawrence Cager, another vital Georgia receiver, is already out for the season. So this is, hey, we talked in the preseason. Georgia receivers, massive concern for this team. And here you go. It's starting to nip them in the bud. And this depth is very, very shallow. At least DeAndre Swift's injury will not keep him out for the LSU game. It was one. I just think it's one of those games, Georgia Tech. Like, Georgia walks away with a win, but probably doesn't feel very good.
All right, we are going to take a quick break, and on the other side, we've still got Bedlam to get into. We've still got Utah to talk to you about, and some coaching carousel news. So stay tuned.
Okay, picture this: it's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Okay, welcome back to the College Football Daily. You know, Trey, we came into this week, the big concern about LSU was their defense, and they go and they hold Texas A&M to 7 points. This was the offense that was number 17 in the country coming in, according to SP Plus, and the LSU outgained A&M 553 to 169. Business as usual from Joe Burrow, 352 yards and 3 touchdowns. But I mean, whether this will be enough to flip LSU back ahead of Ohio State, I kind of doubt it, given the caliber of Ohio State's win. But, I mean, this is an encouraging sign, I think, from an LSU defense that we know has the talent, but we haven't always seen the production from this season.
Yeah, they must have been listening to everybody the last few weeks ever since the Ole Miss game. 7 points. Come on, Texas A&M. Like, that's, oh my gosh, that's horrible. LSU, Connor, I think you're right. I don't think LSU jumps Ohio State this week, but this is impressive enough to start to lay the groundwork for them jumping Ohio State if LSU beats Georgia convincingly. So I think we're gonna, there's a lot of back and forth here. I probably have to eat my words a little bit about LSU not being a complete team, because it's not like A&M doesn't have offensive pieces, and you're right, like, top 20 units. So, good for LSU. Good for Dave Aranda. He was probably not too thrilled not being the hot new coordinator anymore in Baton Rouge. So,
I mean, it's not like you were wrong. I mean, their defense was 29th in the country, according to SP Plus, coming into this week, which, is fine for most teams, but for a team that's has aspirations of going to head to head with the likes of Clemson and Ohio State, like, that's a potentially significant liability. I think maybe if we come out of this period and LSU ends up having a defense that is producing to the caliber of the individual pieces, I think what we might look back and see is that a lot of the points and yards that they gave up were on the road to Texas and Alabama offenses that ended up being top 10 units. I mean, we just saw Alabama, even without Tua Tagovailoa, go into Auburn and score 45, which is, you know, a top five defense in the country, maybe the best defense in the country. So if we look back on this period and conclude that our concerns about LSU's defense were misplaced, I think that might end up being why. And now that LSU does have to concentrate and make a concerted effort to demonstrate that they do have a good defense, like, maybe there's a little bit more focus and determination about going out and proving a point down in, down out for this unit.
Yeah. Like, no national champion in the playoff era has won with a defense that ranks outside, I believe, the top 16. So LSU would be the outlier. So the numbers favor them not winning the national title. But there's nothing to say that they can't in the next three games, or two games, really, because I think, I mean, they're in regardless of what happens against Georgia. Nothing to say that this collection of defensive talent can't string together the makings of a top 10 defense. I mean, they've got 3 to 4 first-round picks on that side of the ball. So we'll see. My concern was the 400-yard rushing game versus Ole Miss. And the Ole Miss runs the ball in a very different manner than Georgia does. Ole Miss is a lot of counter and trap and, you know, quarterback run game. Georgia will just lean on you. Mm-hmm. So we'll see. So different type of test, but can you stop the run? Can LSU stop the run against Georgia? Because it's gonna absolutely have to stop the run against either J.K. Dobbins or Travis Etienne or whoever plays in the semifinal.
Yeah, defensive performance from LSU against A&M was so impressive that it moved them up from 29th in SP Plus to 22nd. So, I mean, maybe they've got enough juice to move up into that top 15 threshold against Georgia. Seem unlikely, but that those numbers at this point in the season are relatively static, and the fact that they turned into performance so dominant that they were able to move that much is really interesting. Speaking of dominant defenses, there's no question about Utah's defensive bona fides. They made relatively quick work of Colorado, beating them 45-15. Did take about a quarter and a half to get going on offense, but the Utes put up a point explosion in the second quarter, and that was all the points that they would need to beat Colorado. They ended up adding a bunch more anyway. Didn't really look to throw the ball a whole lot, but when Tyler Huntley did drop back and throw, they had some pretty explosive plays. So this, of course, locks up the Pac-12 South for the Utes, and we are now headed for a date on Friday with between Utah and Oregon for the Pac-12 title, with the Pac-12, you know, kind of fighting for its playoff life here through the Utes.
Yeah, it did take some time. I was a little bit confused as to why Utah didn't look a little bit better. I have more thoughts on the Utes. I'm going to wait to see how they play against Oregon before really. I don't want to hurt any Utah fans' feelings. I think we have gotten to a point now where we have three teams in college football. Like, I think when I look at Utah and I look at the other teams they could be in the playoff with, I don't think there's a comparison.
Yeah,
I'll save it for another. I'll save it.
Yeah, I think there. It'll be interesting to see what happens on Friday. I think you can make a case for the fact that maybe Utah's offense has taken a significant enough step forward over the course of this season that they legitimately belong in that top four conversation. I would like to see what they do against Oregon before feeling definitive one way or another. And that's fine, because they need to beat Oregon to even be in the conversation anyway. So I don't think anyone can fault us too much for reserving judgment for one more week. Oklahoma 34, Oklahoma State 16. Kind of, you know, it's bedlam here. This game has a bit of a reputation, but so kind of interesting in that context to get our most steady Oklahoma performance in a little while here. They did it by really leaning hard on the run game, just 17 passes attempted in this one for the Sooners compared to 44 runs. And extremely notably, given how the second half of the season has gone, no turnovers for Oklahoma.
No turnovers for Oklahoma. That's exactly what they needed to do. That's exactly, like we talked about, LSU listened to its haters about the defensive side of the ball. Oklahoma's turnover margin, one of the worst in the country. It wasn't sexy, and I'm kind of wondering what version of Oklahoma, like what, like where is September OU? It's clearly not coming back, but that's okay because this was a comfortable win in a rivalry that even last year was like a 1-point game. So good for OU. The Big 12 title game is going to be very, very interesting because did you see, we don't want to spend too much time on it. Did you see what Baylor did to Kansas?
I mean, I'm aware of what the score was.
I didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of
61-6.
Yeah. So, I mean, Baylor in the past couple of weeks kind of showing that perhaps it has a gear that we hadn't previously seen in the way they kind of manhandled Texas and now Kansas. And Kansas, you know, they're a 3-win team. But, I mean, Baylor has been in close games almost every single game this season. So to see them blow a team out is pretty notable. It is worth pointing out that this was not an offensive explosion from the Bears somehow. Only 243 yards of total offense. This was powered by 6 Jayhawks turnovers. They had as many turnovers as points in this one. But I mean, hey, that's one way to score points. I mean, it sets up an intriguing rematch here for the Big 12 title game. These two teams maybe playing a little bit differently than they had earlier in the season.
I'm excited. It's Baylor. I think Baylor can make the playoff if they beat OU. So that's
interesting.
I think they get the leg up over. I know we have a podcast to talk about. I think they get the leg up over Utah.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see, setting up an interesting battle between the Big 12 and the Pac 12 with Alabama out of it now. All right, Trey, let's move on to some coaching carousel items here. We've had Greg Schiano. Rutgers ended up hiring Greg Schiano. I thought this was dead in the water, but it looks like this ended up getting done, huh?
Fan backlash led to Greg Schiano getting the Rutgers job. Fan backlash to Rutgers not coming through an agreement with him. 2 weeks ago or 1 week ago, Rutgers was skewered for not being able to meet Greg Schiano's demands, which were monetarily nice, 8 years, $32 million per Feldman. And Rutgers needing to build a football-only facility. So Rutgers didn't want to do that. Fans let them have it. And Rutgers comes back and hires Greg Schiano, which, of course, is a perfectly bizarre way for him to come full circle 2 years after Tennessee fans revolted about his possible hiring. So he's back, and the Rutgers Scarlet Knights are already trending for a top 100 recruit, Jalen Berger, a running back from New Jersey. So look, like I think Greg Schiano like could actually make Rutgers respectable again, which is all they could hope for.
We did do a podcast several months ago when Chris Ash was fired with Sam Hellman, who works for our news desk now and previously covered Rutgers for quite some time. So maybe we'll rerun that episode at some point this week, just kind of reassessing what Schiano was able to do during his first run at Rutgers and how he was able to build them into a successful program. And I think it's a worthy question to, yes, he is a fit for a lot of reasons, but I mean, were there some unique circumstances around that first run that kind of allowed him to have some success that maybe those circumstances aren't still there? They were in the Big East still at the time. And it was a Big East that was losing Miami and Virginia Tech at much different set of circumstances now, not being in the Big East, but being in the Big Ten East and having to go against Penn State, Ohio State, Michigan State every single year. So it'll be interesting. I guess, you know, that recruiting buzz is pretty exciting, but be interesting to see how that plays out in the long run for sure. Not coming back next year is Barry Odom at Missouri, fired after going 25-25 in four seasons. You know, some kind of a weird year for Missouri. They had this NCAA ruling about their bowl eligibility hanging over their head. They had Kelly Bryant transferring in from Clemson, that ultimately not resulting in a particularly productive offense, but the Tigers kind of being aggressive here and pulling the trigger.
Yeah, I mean, they started off 5-1, and they lost five straight. I think that's – anytime you lose five straight games, I think it's an indictment on, you know, what's going on inside the locker room. Because we looked at Missouri as a top 25, this team could be 8-0 by the time they played Georgia type of team. And they were also horrible on the road, which was like one of the worst road teams ever. So it'd be interesting to see what Mizzou does. Geographically, it's a weird fit in the SEC, but it recruits decently. Like Missouri should be better than it is. I think you juxtapose what Missouri's doing with what a few other schools aren't doing, like your South Carolina Gamecocks. I think it's sort of interesting. It'll be interesting to see in a year, you know, who was rewarded for having faith and rocking with stability, and who was rewarded for, you know, getting out of something that they don't think is going to be, you know, prosperous in the long term. And we've got, like, speaking of, like, make the move now or later, like, it's very sketchy reports right now about Clay Helton's future as we're recording this. Bleacher Report just ran with, I don't think, a very rock-solid report. But, you know, it looks like by the time our podcast airs, like, we could have some movement at USC too, which I think if USC does, or, you know, depending on when you listen to this, did move on from Clay Helton, that's the right call. That is the right call. They spent the entire season with us operating under the assumption that they would, and they've maybe warmed up to the idea of keeping him for another year, but he's a lame duck coach and they're recruiting in the 60s right now. And it's hard to, they're never going to be able to have a good recruiting class with a lame duck coach operating him. So I'm going to tentatively put him, Connor, under the status of, well, I'm not going to say he's not back, but I mean, I'm not going to say he's not back either. And speaking of not back, I'm interested to see if any of our podcast listeners know the name Frank Wilson at UTSA. He just went 4-8 and he's been fired. He was a really, really important part of what LSU was able to do under Les Miles as far as a recruiter. So he now could be a pretty coveted free agent, Frank Wilson could, for schools in the Texas and the SEC areas to go get an absolute ace of a recruiter.
You know, Florida State just got blown out by Florida. And we've seen James Franklin's name connected to the Florida State job in the media, and I know he's been denying it. How seriously are you taking those rumors?
I think James Franklin is probably a more logical fit at USC if that comes open than Florida State. Florida State's had an easier path to a national title than Penn State. Better recruiting base, all that jazz. And I also think there's a time, unless you're winning titles, that coaches probably need to move on from a job. Or else, yeah, I mean, it's the way the hot seat comes and goes so quickly is it's crazy. Like Mark D'Antonio at Michigan State. He's fallen out of favor after, you know, 4 years ago and they were in the playoffs. So I think James Franklin, absolutely. Like I think in the past there have been jobs that James Franklin has been linked to, like every single year where it's like, no, this is just James Franklin finding a way to get more money. But I think Florida State could be a spot for him because it doesn't seem like they're going to keep interim coach Odell Higgins, which there had weirdly been some buzz for. I think probably in the wake of what LSU's done with Ed Orgeron, there's like a new appreciation for interim head coaches. But I think Florida State, if it's not James Franklin, it's maybe Matt Campbell or Mike Norvell. It's not going to be Mark Stoops or Bob Stoops.
It's interesting what you say about Franklin. It kind of got me thinking, like, football is kind of, well, not every sport in the world is one where the baseline expectation is that if a coach is having success at the place that he's at, well, then he just stays there forever until he stops having success. Like in soccer, at least, like coaches just kind of come in, achieve what they can achieve, and then kind of like look for a new challenge. But college football culturally is very different, I guess. But maybe it's possible that James Franklin might be wired a little differently in that regard. We do have some coaches who are, I believe, confirmed as coming back. Let's start with Joe Moorhead at Mississippi State. We didn't talk about the Egg Bowl, but my word.
Oh, my God.
if dude lifting his leg in the end zone ends up being the thing that keeps Joe Moorhead at Mississippi State, and that, I mean, it's fascinating to think that 5 years from now, we could look back at that as a significant turning point in the direction of either Mississippi State, Ole Miss, or both.
Yeah, Steve Robertson, a 24/7 sports reporter over at jeanspage.com, which is our Mississippi State site, said he's coming back on the grounds that the administration liked the team's, you know, preparedness for the Egg Bowl. And again, if Elijah Moore doesn't, you know, lift his leg up, we could be talking about a totally different game. Just insane. I think it's nuts to base a decision like that with millions of dollars in the balance over one game. But that's clearly what they've done here. I don't think anyone thinks that Joe Moorhead is a fit at Mississippi State. He even sort of tongue-in-cheek alluded to it. He said, you're going to have to drag my Yankee ass out of here. The Northeastern guy, he's not a fit in the South, which is an annoying thing to say. Like, I don't want to be the guy who's like, he's not a fit down here. But it's just not the most natural marriage. But at 14-11, Mississippi State fans, like, this is interesting. Dan Mullen spoiled them a little bit. Like, they're no – Mississippi State is 10 years removed from being – should have – you know, they should be thrilled to make bowl games given, you know, their program's history. And now they're disappointed in last year's 8-4 season. So I think Joe Moorhead's going to be the victim of Dan Mullen's success down there. And I think I'd be surprised if he's still around in 2 years.
We also had, I guess, did Arizona confirm that Kevin Sumlin will be back?
Kevin Sumlin is returning. He is, I believe, 9-15 in two seasons. This is an interesting one because Kevin Sumlin should be doing a way better job than he is. He pretty much robbed us of 2 years of Khalil Tate. He's 3-7 against the Pac-12 South. He's going to have to hire a new defensive coordinator. And it's not like he took over a program that was in the dumps. Rich Rodriguez got fired for reasons totally not related to on-the-field success. But Kevin Sumlin, in his third year, and I have to say, I don't disagree with this decision because I'm starting to look at Kevin Sumlin in a sort of fonder light, looking at like what he did at Texas A&M, 9-3, 8-4, 8-4, 9, like they would take that right now. So I think Kevin Sumlin is a good football coach. I don't know if Arizona could get someone better than him. I think a third year is the move. And it's very clear that 3 years is like, we used to say, give coaches 4 years. And like the past few years we've been saying, give them three. I think it's 2 years is starting to become the new three, right?
Yeah, like, it certainly feels like it.
People are making moves. Yeah, people are making moves. And there's one coach, Manny Diaz at Miami. They just lost to Duke. They lost to FIU. They've lost to Georgia Tech. I don't think Miami can afford to make a move. But we could be seeing our very first in a long time firing after one season not related to off-the-field issues. Just keep an eye on it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, they honestly have not been a team that's been very much on my radar this season as far as me having an understanding about what has gone wrong there, because they just kind of losing some games early, just kind of totally fell off the national picture. But yeah, I mean, I guess it was possible that they would have a season like this. But I mean, it is year one, but man, you thought, given the pieces returning, given the pieces coming in through the transfer portal, that the results would be a little bit better there. I'm rooting for Diaz as an analytics guy and a young guy kind of being a, so I hope he's able to stick around and get things figured out. That'd be kind of a bummer to see Miami kind of get stuck in this malaise after it seemed like they were well and truly back just a couple of years ago. And I guess
no one's ever really back, Connor.
Yeah, that's true. Will Muschamp seems like he's coming back. And that's certainly been the consistent well, relatively consistent messaging from the South Carolina administration. But I kind of had it in the back of my head. Well, like, sure, you say he's coming back no matter what happens in Clemson, but have you really thought about what it's going to feel like with the Williams-Brice Stadium, 50% Clemson fans and a total blowout for a sixth year in a row? I guess there's maybe two close-ish games in there, but as of when we're talking on Sunday, it looks like they are sticking to that. I kind of thought that the reality of confronting that situation might change some minds a bit, but I guess it hasn't. Anyway, I think that's going to do it for today's episode of the College Football Daily. We'll be back tomorrow, as we always do, I guess for the last time this year, kind of previewing what we're going to see from the College Football Playoff Selection Committee on Tuesday night. If you appreciate what we're doing here at the College Football Daily, we ask that you do one thing this week to help spread the word about the show. Ideally, one of those things would include leaving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. For Trey Scott and our producer, Tony Levitt, I'm Connor Tappan. We'll see you tomorrow for the next episode of the College Football Daily.
Paramount Plus and the National Park Foundation present A Mountain of Zen. Are you still listening? Good. Take a deep breath. You needed a break. This Earth Week, you can live stream 7 national parks for 7 days on Paramount Plus. So, yes, you can literally stream a stream. Paramount Plus, official streaming partner of the National Park Foundation.